Hello and welcome to the Sydney Institute podcast. The Institute is Australia's premier current affairs forum. Every week, contemporary political, social, cultural and economic issues are explored at the Institute through dialogue and discussion. This podcast was recorded recently at a members' forum in the city of Sydney. Thanks for listening, and for more information about the Sydney Institute, please visit www.thesydneyinstitute.com.au. We hope you enjoy this event.
Thanks for coming along tonight, folks. We're not usually into cliches at the Sydney Institute, but we're using the term icons tonight because it's an easy term to use. And so we've got a discussion on Labor icons, Paul Keating and Lionel Murphy, and we have two speakers, and I'll introduce them very briefly in the order in which they will speak. Stephen Walmsley is a retired judge, and he's recently the author of a book that sold very well, The Trials of Justice Murphy, LexisNexis. It's a bit hard to get in bookshops, but it's easy to get at the Sydney Institute. And Stephen Walmsley is going to speak on Lionel Murphy for about 15 minutes, and then Troy Bramston, who makes a welcome return to the Sydney Institute. He's a senior writer of The Australian. He's an author of a number of books, a contributor to Sky News, and most recently the author of Paul Keating, The Big Picture Leader, which has also sold extremely well, and there are not many copies of that book available either. And so we'll lead off with Stephen Walmsley, then we'll go to Troy Bramston, and then we'll go to questions and discussion. Stephen, you're welcome. Thank you.
Thank you, Drew. When judges are appointed to the High Court of Australia, most Australians have never heard of them. But the appointments are rarely controversial. However, when Justice Lionel Murphy was appointed to the High Court on the 14th of February 1975, he was one of the best known politicians in the country. He was by no means the first politician appointed to the court, but of those who had been politicians, even including Sir Garfield Barwick, he was probably the most controversial. The legal profession appreciates more than most the importance of having highly competent and uncontroversial judges, especially on the High Court. Although the legal profession is usually warm in its celebration of High Court appointments, it was less than wholehearted in its welcome for Murphy. Justice Murphy served on the High Court for 10 years and 8 months, dying from cancer on the 21st of October 1986, just an hour after his last judgments were delivered. For two-thirds of his time as a High Court judge, he was involved personally in litigation concerning allegations about his personal conduct. For the last 22 months of his life, he sat for only 3 days on the court. The first 4 years he was a High Court judge, he, along with former Prime Minister Gough Whitlam and former Whitlam ministers Rex Connor and Jim Cairns, was forced to fight allegations that they had committed criminal conspiracies to avoid compliance with Commonwealth laws concerning the raising of money by the Commonwealth. This was the private prosecution laid by Sydney solicitor Danny Sankey, which arose from the loans affair. Sankey's private prosecution did not stop Murphy from sitting as a judge, but he was required to attend court when his committal proceedings were heard at the Court of Petty Sessions in Queanbeyan. The Sankey prosecution was launched on the 20th of November 1975, just 9 days after the dismissal of the Whitlam government, but it was not until early in 1979 when the Queanbeyan magistrate hearing the case, Mr. Darcy Leo, found that none of the accused had a case to answer, and the case against them was dismissed. I should say that by that time, Rex Connor had died. He died in 1977. By 1983, Murphy was the country's third most senior judge. In February 1984, The Age published what purported to be transcripts of phone calls illegally recorded by New South Wales police. They contain salacious discussions in which a judge apparently bragged to a solicitor friend about some sexual and drinking exploits. Neither was named, but it was soon publicly known that Murphy was the judge. As it turned out, The Age had made a serious mistake, accidentally swapping around the parties to the conversation, incorrectly attributing to Murphy what had been said by the solicitor and vice versa. The Age did apologise, but the apology was neither early nor handsome. Other purported transcripts of Murphy's conversations published by The Age without the transposition errors did not obviously disclose criminal conduct, but did not reflect well on Murphy's character. There was no evidence the recordings were genuine, but the Hawke Labor government came under pressure to take action to protect the High Court's standing. The steps Hawke took did not satisfy Murphy's critics, and the Senate, which Labor did not control, set up the first of what proved to be two Senate inquiries into the Labor hero. The story behind my book, The Trials of Justice Murphy, began with the first of the Senate inquiries. Murphy had been a powerful figure in the Whitlam governments and had a good mix of friends and enemies. Troy Bramston makes clear in Paul Keating, the big picture leader, that though the two were from different factions, Keating admired Murphy's legal mind and his radical thinking. But I do note that according to Murphy's biographer, Keating said in a 1998 interview on this issue, he thought Murphy, in choosing not to resign when these allegations arose, and in allowing his own suffering to continue, was a professional martyr. Friends of Murphy, and he still has many, would say that the Senate inquiries and the subsequent trials would not have taken place had he been uncontroversial or a former Conservative politician. Some saw his prosecution as a payback for the prosecution by the Rand government of Ian Sinclair, the former leader of the National Country Party, who was charged with forgery and acquitted in 1980. After the second Senate inquiry, Murphy, as many will recall, was charged with attempting to pervert the course of justice. These charges involved what were said to be attempts to lean on a magistrate and a judge to help his friend Morgan Ryan, who he called his little mate, to get off some criminal charges. There were many remarkable aspects to this affair. First, there was the country's third most senior judge, a man who indeed sometimes acted as Chief Justice of the High Court, charged with serious criminal offences, which on conviction would inevitably result in a lengthy period of imprisonment. It's an uncomfortable thought to have today when you consider 30 years later one of our own current High Court judges being charged with such an offence, but that was the situation 30 years ago. Then there were the personalities involved. The allegations against Murphy were made by significant members of the judiciary. The first to speak up was the Chief Magistrate of New South Wales, Clary Breeze. When he spoke up, he was mercilessly attacked by Murphy supporters. These supporters were not just any members of the public. One was the then New South Wales Premier, Neville Rann QC, who for much of his term as Premier was also Minister for Police. Instead of taking the allegations seriously, Rann publicly condemned Breeze, calling on him to resign. Another Murphy supporter, a then journalist from the Bulletin called Malcolm Turnbull, not only attacked Breeze, also telling him to resign, but described the first Senate committee as a kangaroo court and attacked his Liberal Party members who had, in their minority finding, found a prima facie case against Murphy. Then it turned out Murphy was not the only judge accused of trying to lean on judicial officers. A New South Wales District Court judge, John Ford QC, was also accused of trying to help Morgan Ryan by unlawful means. He, like Murphy, was also a friend of Ryan, and he, like Murphy, also wanted to help Ryan with his troubles. These vicious attacks on the Chief Magistrate by Rann and Turnbull and others led the trial judge in Morgan Ryan's case, the late Paul Flannery QC, to come forward with allegations that Murphy and Ford had tried to nobble him when the trial was proceeding. Throughout the Murphy affair, the part played by the inaugural Commonwealth Director of Public Prosecutions, Ian Temby QC, was significant. He was appointed by the Hawke government. The office of DPP is independent of government, and Temby's appointment allowed him to make decisions an Attorney General would have found politically awkward to make. It was he who decided to charge Murphy. For exercising this independent discretion, he also was attacked publicly by Rann, who somewhat hypocritically called him a media tart. Rann being a well-known media tart himself. Rann, a QC for decades, the state premier, was later charged with and convicted of contempt of court for extravagant support of public comments he made to Daily Telegraph journalists, expressing the very strong view to them that Murphy was innocent. Rann made these remarks just before Murphy's second trial was to begin. The Daily Telegraph's publisher was also convicted of contempt of court for publishing Rann's comments. In the course of the Murphy trials, there was evidence that Murphy had dropped in to see the Chief Judge of the District Court to ask if his friend Morgan Ryan could have a speedy trial. Although the approach was not illegal, it would be absolutely unthinkable today for a High Court judge to make such an approach to any judge of any court. Indeed, I could not imagine any Australian judge today at any level of any court even considering making such an approach for a friend. I would have thought most of those who appreciated how the legal system worked would have thought it unthinkable in 1982. But Murphy apparently saw this as something he could do because he and the Chief Judge went back somewhat, having been friends at the bar, just drop into his chambers for a little chat. I hasten to point out that when approached, the Chief Judge, James Staunton QC, behaved absolutely appropriately, politely sending Murphy on his way. Then there was another judge involved in the affair whose name you may recall, who, when in politics, was known as Diamond Jim McClelland. He was a minister in the second Whitlam government, and Troy Bramston has described his elevation from backbencher in Paul Keating, the big picture leader. When Murphy went looking for help from Morgan Ryan, he also asked McClelland to help him. By this time, McClelland, who'd lost his Senate seat in the 1975 election, had become the Chief Judge of the Land and Environment Court of New South Wales, appointed by the Rand government. McClelland gave sworn evidence four times over the 2 years of the Murphy affair about assistance he had given to Murphy with Ryan's case. After McClelland died in early 1999, journalists David Maher and Wendy Bacon revealed that before he died, McClelland had confessed to each of them that when giving evidence, he'd perjured himself to help Murphy win. The details of how McClelland tried to help and his confessions of perjury and whether he did in fact commit perjury are matters which I discuss in a chapter in my book. So the Murphy affair involved a very senior High Court judge, the New South Wales Chief Magistrate, two District Court judges, the Chief Judge of the District Court and the Chief Judge of the Land and Environment Court. There was also involvement by then Governor General, former High Court Judge Sir Ninian Stephen, who, after Murphy's ultimate acquittal, was asked by Bob Hawke to advise Murphy to resign. There is no suggestion that Sir Ninian did make that request, but judging by Murphy's response to similar suggestions from then Attorney General and Senator Gareth Evans several years before that, it can be assumed that any such suggestions would have fallen on deaf ears. I've always admired whistleblowers. They're often brave people the establishment does not want to hear about or from. They're often sacked or demoted or criticised for their roles. They're often women. This state has a sorry history of the way it has treated whistleblowers. Those with long memories will recall the New South Wales police officer, the late Detective Sergeant Philip Arantz, who in 1971 ended up in a mental ward and was later sacked after publicly questioning blatantly incorrect crime clear-up rates heralded by a corrupt police commissioner who was himself supported by the then Premier. The idea for this book first arose for me after I met one of the whistleblowers against Murphy, the late Paul Flannery QC, who became my father-in-law. My meeting with his daughter Leonie and my later discussions with his family, especially Paul's wife Rosemary, about how the case had invaded and affected their lives, coupled with the fact that Rosemary Flannery had kept about 20 boxes of press clippings from the time, gave me the idea for the book. The other whistleblower, Clary Breeze, like Paul Flannery, also a very brave man, also suffered greatly for doing what he thought was right. Clary Breeze, I should say, has given me a great deal of help when I wrote the book. The book describes both Senate inquiries, the committal hearing in the local court, the first trial, the sentencing, the appeal, the second trial, and the Commission of Inquiry set up by the Hawke government to inquire into new allegations. It has a close look at the New South Wales jury system in action. The Commission of Inquiry was wound up before completing its task when Murphy announced that he was dying. The Parliament decided that the public should wait 30 years before having access to the material the Commission was examining. In fact, Hawke at the time wanted there never to be a time when the material was to come out, but the Democrats did a deal and got the time reduced from forever to 30 years. That time was up on the 24th of September last year. Today's legal journal Justinian reported that Clary Breeze, who is currently writing a book on his perspective of the affair, has just been given access to the material. The material can be expected to be meaty. A number of significant matters were being examined. One of my intentions when I wrote this book was to provide an understanding of the background to the Hawke government's 30-year statutory protection of Murphy's memory. Do I think High Court Justice Murphy was guilty of attempting to pervert the course of justice? I would prefer readers make up their own minds about that. Although one of Murphy's accusers was my late father-in-law, I have attempted to write an objective account. The book is based on documents, largely written from court and Senate committee transcripts and contemporary press clippings. I invite the reader to read the book as a juror might look at the evidence in a trial. Although I hope lawyers will enjoy the book, I've also written it for the non-lawyer reader with an interest in the history of the High Court and Australian politics of the 1980s. I'm very grateful to the Sydney Institute and to Gerard Henderson for asking me to speak tonight, especially on the same platform as such a distinguished writer and author as Troy Bramston, whose work I much admire. Thank you. Thanks.
Well, thank you all for coming. I'd like to acknowledge Gerard and Anne for inviting me back to the Sydney Institute. This is the fifth time I've spoken from this platform, and I want to pay tribute to the important role that the Sydney Institute plays in fostering debate and discussion in this great city, and also it's a pleasure to share a platform with Stephen. My book, Paul Keating, The Big Picture Leader, tells a story of a truly remarkable life. A great Australian life, and I believe a legacy which changed Australia forever. There's never been a politician quite like Paul Keating. He left school at 14, he was in Parliament at 25, he was a minister at 31, treasurer at 39, and prime minister at 47. He was a political leader who dreamed big dreams and he took big risks. He told me, to be any good at this game, you must have the crazy gene. And above all, he believed that good policy is good politics. Although he was loved by some and loathed by others, even his opponents, I think, now recognise that he blazed a trail of reform and that he deserves our respect. He had a vision and he could develop, articulate and implement policy change. When you survey politics today, this could not be more relevant. But it took me a long time to get Paul Keating to cooperate with this project. He's not cooperated with a biographer in more than 20 years. Frankly, he dislikes biographies, and he's unlikely to write a memoir. He said to me, if you're any good, other people will write about you. Well, I guess that's true. But after Keating launched my book of essays about Neville Wran in 2006, I said to him, I'd like to do a book about him next. He looked at me and he said, I don't think so, mate, and then walked off. He brushed off my pleas for years, but finally he agreed to interviews and he gave me access to his papers. But it is an unauthorised biography, which is how we both wanted it to be. I want to stress this point, that Keating only reluctantly cooperated with this book, even though in the end he was generous with his time. But he had no control over the final manuscript, or the research, or the interviews that I did. Ian Hancock, a historian that I greatly admire and someone who's spoken at the Sydney Institute, urged me to show Keating the manuscript before publication. So I gave it to Keating 1 week before we went to print. Every day he rang me to complain about the limited time I'd given him to respond. He identified some minor errors and he provided some new information, but I did not accept many of the changes he wanted me to make. For example, Alistair Campbell told me that Keating had said to him once that when he left politics, he planned to have an answering machine with a message. The message was, hello, you've contacted the office of former Prime Minister Paul Keating. Now fuck off and leave me alone. Now Keating wanted me to take this out of the book, but I refused to do so. But I did add a sentence saying that he believes this did not happen. But I believe Alistair Campbell. In this biography, there are new insights into Keating's parents, his grandparents, his childhood and his schooling, his early career at the Sydney County Council, the Wheelock Marden Trading Company and the Municipal Employees Union, his navigation through Labor ranks, an election to Parliament and the turmoil of the Whitlam years, his complex and very nuanced relationships with Gough Whitlam, Bill Hayden, Bob Hawke and John Howard. I chronicle Keating's years as Treasurer, when, along with Bob Hawke and a talented cabinet, he turned Labor orthodoxy on its head, smashed the policy foundations of the Federation era, and remade Australia. It is recognised, I believe, that as Treasurer, Keating was one of the principal architects of the post-war economic reforms, floating the dollar, major tax changes including slashing company and personal income tax rates, financial sector deregulation, the Accord, asset sales and four budget surpluses, the first since the 1950s. I believe the big picture Keating Prime Ministership warrants a reassessment. The economic reforms from this period are often overlooked. Superannuation, enterprise bargaining, competition policy, trade liberalisation and welfare reform. His shuttle diplomacy created the APEC leaders meeting and he took relationships in Asia to another level. He put the Republic on the agenda, he sought to redefine our history and initiated the first national cultural policy. And as lead minister, he secured the Native Title Act when it often looked doomed to fail. And in the book there are glimpses into Keating's personal life, including his marriage to Anita. He told me that being Prime Minister put a strain on the marriage and contributed to their separation in 1998. Anne Keating, Paul's sister, told me that they'd had a happy marriage until he became Prime Minister. Researching and writing this book has been exhaustive, but also enthralling. I believe it's more extensive than anything previously undertaken on Paul Keating. 15 hours of new interviews with Keating and access to his personal and private archive, more than 100 interviews with other people, and thousands of pages of new archival documents. For weeks and weeks, I sat at desks in places like the National Archives, the Reserve Bank, the National Library, the State Libraries in Sydney and Melbourne, surrounded by piles of dusty files. But for me, it's like hopping inside H.G. Wells' time machine and being transported to the past. And that's how these stories about Paul Keating's stormy time in Young Labor, his controversial 1968 Blaxland pre-selection, and his contribution to caucus and cabinet debates are discovered. It's been a thrill to interview Keating's family, friends, former staff and parliamentary colleagues, alongside party officials, union leaders, public servants and journalists, and even his high school principal and members of the Ramrods band. It was an honour also to speak to Tony Abbott, Julia Gillard, Kevin Rudd and John Howard about their predecessor. I also used my interviews previously with Gough Whitlam, Malcolm Fraser and Bob Hawke. And I spoke to Bill Hayden, Doug Anthony, Andrew Peacock, John Hewson, Alexander Downer, Kim Beazley, Simon Crean and many others. Many of these interviews were very frank and revealing. So this book offers a broadly favourable but certainly not uncritical account of Paul Keating's life and legacy. The mistakes and misjudgments which every politician makes are candidly discussed and some are even acknowledged by the subject himself. I'm critical of economic policy making going into and out of the 1990 recession and Keating's this is the recession we had to have comment. He did not sufficiently nurse the economic narrative while Prime Minister and he made two key political mistakes as Prime Minister. He reduced his question time appearances, which led to the suggestion he was a part-time PM, was seen to be dismissing Parliament, and it denied the government his skills as a political combatant. He also ignored much of the media after the 1993 election, because most of the journalists did not believe he could win the unwinnable election. This was understandable, but it denied him an opportunity to argue his case to voters. But there's a key theme in this book, and that is how power is earned, how it's used, and inevitably, how it's lost. How Paul Keating learnt about power is instructive. The Catholic nuns and brothers taught Paul Keating what was in his soul, but it was the nonagenarian former Premier Jack Lang who instructed him in his politics. He read books about Winston Churchill, Franklin Roosevelt, and the Kennedys. In Canberra, he was mindful of Jack Lang's advice. People will say you have plenty of time, but the truth is, you haven't got a second to lose. He understood that politics is a learning profession. He got to know Arthur Calwell. He ate breakfast with Labor men twice his age at the Kurrajong Hotel. He befriended Rex Connor. He studied John Gordon and Billy McMahon deeply in question time. He was an astute judge of Gough Whitlam and Malcolm Fraser. He met business leaders. He developed relationships with journalists like Max Walsh, Laurie Oakes, Alan Ramsey and Paul Kelly. And he built contacts in the public service. He often saw party conferences like a boxer saw the ring. Defeat by Labor's left faction was untenable. Only Robert Menzies and Gough Whitlam would rival him for top honours in Parliament. And although he encountered resistance in the Labor caucus when he arrived in 1969, he was soon working the numbers like an old pro. In many ways, this book is a primer on political power. For example, Keating told me that everything he'd learnt, including chairing meetings of Young Labor in the 1960s, was essential for him to deliver the Native Title Act in 1993 against entrenched and seemingly intractable opposition. To many Australians, Paul Keating remains an enigma, a statesman and a brawler, a political animal and a collector of fine antiques, a factional numbers man and a policy intellect. So I try to unpack this bundle of paradoxes. He satisfied his restless energy by becoming an expert on antiques and classical music. He was also a car enthusiast. He earned a pilot's licence and he bred budgerigars. He saw Parliament as the central cockpit of politics where intellectual hegemony had to be mastered and kept. He had a tongue that could clip a hedge. He described John Howard as a dead carcass swinging in the breeze. He asked Andrew Peacock, after returning as Liberal leader, could a souffle rise twice? He compared Malcolm Fraser to an Easter Island statue with an arse full of razor blades. He called Alexander Down to the Christmas turkey. Peter Costello was a low-altitude flyer. And he said John Hewson was a shiver looking for a spine to run up. And of course, no doubt, as you all know, he explained to John Hewson that he wouldn't call an early election because I want to do you slowly, mate. Parliament was psychological warfare for Paul Keating. Yet he also reached the heights of oratorical brilliance with the Redfern speech on reconciliation and the eulogy for the unknown soldier. Then again, the warrior was evident when Parliament House was blockaded with logging trucks in 1995. Keating wanted army tow trucks to drag the logging trucks away or crush them if necessary. He was so furious with the CFMEU. I said to Paul, "Are you serious?" He said, "Yes." And I said, "Why?" And he said, "Because, mate, you can't let scum run the government." And yet, there is another side. I asked Kim Beazley what is the one thing that people should know about Paul Keating that they may not. "Kindness towards others," was his reply. Paul's advisor, Marianne O'Loughlin, recalled a meeting with carers. There was no media present and he took little notice of the office briefing. "The work you do is invaluable," he told them. "You will all go straight to heaven, bypass limbo and bypass purgatory." Their hearts swelled. Nothing else he could have said would have touched them more. Keating guarded his privacy and he never showed his emotions publicly. He paid a price for not allowing the public to see this side of him, and also as a devoted family man. He told me, "I gave them my heart and my brain. I was not going to give them my soul." Like all prime ministers, Keating has wrestled with history. "Every prime minister since Robert Menzies has been taken out in a box," Keating said, and he was no exception. He told me that he has gotten over the 1996 election defeat and that he doesn't hate John Howard, but he does believe the country made a mistake at that election. Now, this is typical Keating, but it is an unexceptional statement. John Howard also believes the voters were wrong to turf out his government in 2007. But was there a Keating factor in the 1996 election defeat? In truth, Keating was a positive and a negative factor for Labor in the 1996 election. The party's research showed this. It is worth recalling that Keating was preferred Prime Minister over John Howard right up until Election Day. And this is because he was seen as a leader of strength and vision, but was not personally liked by many voters. While I argue that Keating was driven more by pride rather than vanity, voters saw him as arrogant. Polls showed voters were also weary after so much economic reform, and the government was frankly lucky to survive in 1990 and 1993, asking for a fifth election victory in a row, while only Robert Menzies has achieved that. I agree with John Howard, who told me that overwhelmingly the reason the Keating government was dispatched with brutal efficiency in 1996 was the its time factor. On election night 1996, I stood as a young university student in the auditorium of the Bankstown Sports Club, and I saw Paul Keating concede defeat but defend his big picture agenda. "In the end, it's the big picture which changes nations," he said. He does not want honours or applause. He wants recognition for the nation-changing reforms. "The reward for public life," he said, "is public progress." When Keating says that Malcolm Turnbull and Bill Shorten lack the vision and ambition that Australia needs and the political authority to deliver major change, who could disagree with that? Now, Gerard Henderson believes that the Keating fan club is broad and prevailing. But it is not only Labor's true believers who have embraced Keating. Tony Abbott, for example, told me that in some ways, Keating is the best politician of his generation. That's some fan club. Now, as is often the case with books, there was a mad rush to the finish line. I pressed Paul Keating to set dates for the final interviews. And then one day, Keating rang me on the phone. "Listen, mate," he said, "just tell that publisher to bugger off. We'll do the interviews in good time. You've got to get this right," he said. "You only get one shot. This book will last forever. You can't go back once it's done." Now, I'd heard about the Keating treatment before. Clearly, I was not immune. He was putting me on notice. But then Paul gave me a message that has ringed in my ears ever since. "Troy," he said, "don't fuck it up." Now, in truth, I didn't need him to tell me this. I know how important this story is, and it's why I wanted to write this book. I hope that readers will have a better understanding of who Paul Keating really is, without fear or favour, and understand better what he stood for and what his legacy is today. Thank you.
Thanks, Troy. As I said, Janet Grundy's got copies of both books there, and I'm sure our speakers will be happy to sign one or the other. Probably not both. So we come to question discussion. We've got a few people here, so we've got to be fairly swift with our questions or comments. Can I get you both to come on, one on either side of the microphone? Stephen, you come around here, and Troy, you stay here, then I'll evacuate here in a minute, and just speak into the microphone. You've both, I'll just start off, Stephen, you gave... Well, you left it up to the jury. I mean, you gave a district court judge judgment and left it up to the jury. And you didn't, but I'm taking the role of a juryman here. If I was on the jury and listened to your report, I mean, having once met Paul Flannery and once met Clary Brees, they seem to me to be pretty decent, solid people. They weren't megalomaniacs, they weren't media tarts. And the question is, why would anyone like Neville Wran think they'd made this sort of these kind of accusations up? They don't. Now, you would know human nature better than I do, being a judge for some time, but why would certain people believe that someone like Flannery or Brees had made it up? And to you, Troy, what did Keating see in Jack Lang? Jack Lang was an anti-Semite, he was a thug. He helped split the Labor Party in New South Wales. He accused Ben Chifley of being a moneylender in the lead-up to the 1949 election. He was a totally unpleasant person. And yet someone who you accurately described as one of the great politicians of Australia saw something in Lang that others, including the late Ben Chifley, didn't see. So just some personal assessments, and then we move on. Stephen.
I think he didn't ever attack Flannery. He certainly attacked Brees over and over and quite viciously. Why would he have done that? Well, he and Murphy were friends, close friends.
Speak up a bit.
Sorry. He and Murphy were close friends. From what I've read, I understand they were at university together. And I understand that that Ford was a friend of Murphy and of Rann as well. So Rann was a great defender of his friends, and I think that's what he was doing. I think he it was a cruel thing to do to Clary Breeze, who was just doing what he thought was the right thing. But on the other hand, the events that he spoke of had occurred several years before he first spoke up. And so there was a vulnerability. But as Breeze later explained, there were good reasons why he didn't come forward earlier. And perhaps one of them is what happened when he did. The other one was that it was really only when the age tapes came out when he recognised the importance of things that had happened in the course of the Ryan trial. Juries are warned whenever people's credit is in issue in a trial. Don't ask, or at least prosecutors are never permitted to say, why would this wonderful witness make this up? There are all sorts of reasons why people make things up, and we don't know. Rann, I'm not sure that Rann made things up, but perhaps his best method, he thought, was simply to attack and try and persuade by attack the man, his friend's accuser, to give up and go away and retire gracefully. But that, of course, didn't work.
Thank you. Troy.
The Jack Lang relationship is really interesting, and I explored this a lot. Jack Lang was a window into history for Paul Keating. He started seeing Lang down the road here at his office at the Century newspaper about the age of 20, spent more than 10 years seeing him almost on a weekly basis. When he was working in the city, he would see him 2 days a week. But Lang was a window into history. Keating wanted to learn, and he thought, how better to learn about politics than to talk to a former premier? His father was a Langite, someone who had voted for the Lang Labor Party, but Keating revealed to me that it was of his own initiative, that one day he just knocked on the door and said he wanted to learn about politics, and so Lang took him in. A number of people who went with Keating to these meetings, like Laurie Brereton and Ron Dyer, told me they thought that Lang was investing in someone. He thought this might be his last chance to really press upon him. So they talked about politics, mainly. How they did it was very interesting. Keating would refer to him as Mr. Lang. Lang would refer to him as Mr. Keating. Remember, Lang's in his 80s or 90s. Keating's barely 20. Keating would have a list of topics he'd put on the table between them. The fob watch would be brought out, and Lang would put it on the table and time the discussion for exactly 1 hour. And they would eat their lunch together. Sometimes Keating would help Lang with the Century newspaper. I don't think there's any evidence that Keating really embraced Lang's ideas, certainly the ones that have been completely discredited. But what he looked to Lang for was to give him pen portraits of people that had faded from history. You know, Lang was at Henry Parkes' rallies in the Domain. He could talk about that. He could talk about what it was like to meet Labor leaders like Matthew Charlton or Chris Watson or what Edmund Barton was like to have a conversation with, or George Reed, how fat really was he? All these kind of things that a young man would ask. And so Lang was a time machine for Keating, and they did develop a very, very close relationship, and I explain in detail how Keating had basically moved heaven and earth to get Lang readmitted to the Labor Party in about 1970-71.
Okay, so, right, question here? Here. Yes.
For Troy, you didn't mention the rivalry between Bob Hawke and Keating for the succession.
Yep.
Question about the rivalry between Hawke and Keating.
Look, it's a really important relationship. It's often been misunderstood, I think. They didn't hate each other, but a quick snapshot is that they were very different people. Very different personalities, very different backgrounds, very different temperaments, very different interests. Keating was interested in antiques. Hawke was interested in the races and sport and things like that. Keating was a straight-laced Catholic boy from Bankstown. Hawke was a womaniser, a lout, a drunk, and all the rest of it. And they didn't get on very well, but they were thrown together by circumstances. And the truth is that they formed perhaps the greatest partnership there's ever been in Australian politics. I mean, they were unbeatable as a political duo. There's no doubt about that. Together, they won four elections. And so they were very, very successful. But what was really interesting to me was I talked to Robert Ray about this, and I said to Robert Ray, look, my assessment of this relationship is there is a deep wellspring of affection between the two men to this day. I mean, they still talk to each other about private matters. They don't hate each other. As much as journalists like us like to write the fireworks from time to time, they have a genuine respect and admiration for each other that's very deep. And so I said this to Robert Ray, and he said, that's true, mate. He said, what you've got to understand is they'd have a better relationship if they actually hated each other. But they don't hate each other.
Question here. Yeah?
Like us, Stephen, in July 1976, Rand resigned, and then Murphy
86.
Died in October 1986. What I can't understand is, What was the Hawke government so concerned about smothering or covering something up for 30 years? Now it's been over 30 years and we still don't know what transpired.
Well, I don't know. I don't know what's in the material. I think we'll learn about it in the next 12 months. Journalists who thought they knew things at the time, Wendy Bacon being one of them, has written that she was summoned by the Commission of Inquiry to give evidence about her conversations with McClelland. So it looks as though they were looking into whether McClelland gave false evidence. Another one which has been looked at, I think, involves what was said to be an offer by Murphy to a police officer to promote him if he assisted in various ways. Callan and QC, the sook from Brisbane who prosecuted Murphy, advised Temby, the DPP, in May 1986, just after the acquittal, Murphy was acquitted, that there was a case that should be brought against Murphy, he should be prosecuted. Now, Temby decided not to do that. My understanding is that's another issue that's being looked at. And there are many others that I just don't know what they are, and I honestly don't know why, but there must have been a good reason why Hawke wanted them shut down.
So, Chris, yes, down there. Yep.
Troy, do you think the circumstances that led to the rise of Keating and Hawke, do you think those circumstances can ever happen again? Or are we in a world where we're never going to have the kind of Labor leaders that those guys were?
Look, it's a good question. I don't really have a clear answer on it. I think we're still sort of working it out. But I think history will look back at Hawke, Keating and Howard as being exceptional prime ministers who achieved a lot, had convictions, could make their case, get voters to vote for them. We've had four very poor prime ministers, in my view, extremely poor. The quality of political leadership has torpedoed in this country under the four prime ministers. So maybe they're just exceptions. I don't know the answer to that just yet. I mean, Malcolm Fraser and Gough Whitlam were both, real significant leaders, titans in their days, but they both had significant flaws. I mean, all political leaders have flaws. But what's interesting to me about that question is that, see, there's a lot of discussion today about the political class and people that go from being a university student to being a trade union official or a staffer and then into Parliament, or in the Liberal Party they might be a staffer and then into Parliament, or a lawyer and then into Parliament. Their craft is politics, but John Howard and Paul Keating's craft was politics as well. They mastered their craft. They had other interests and they did other things, but there's a problem where the present generation of politicians who have made politics their craft haven't mastered it. And so it's a really interesting question, and I think we're in a point of transition at the moment. And I don't know whether it's because they're exceptional or whether there's something wrong with the system itself.
Stephen.
So, Troy, how fundamental was it then that Keating learned how to play politics from people like Jeff Lang in order to end up putting through a suite of policies that you would say if you were looking at a continuum of non-Labour policies? Forms that he put through. So was it because he had schooled himself so well that he was then able to play the numbers? Or was it the fact that the cohort around him also were a cabinet and a set of ministers that were capable of thinking more widely?
I don't think they were non-Labour policies. I think there's a very good argument for why open markets and a deregulated economy can help working people. One of Paul Keating's great complaints about Labor today is that he says he and Bob Hawke effectively created the middle class in Australia today, the entrepreneurial, aspirational middle class that didn't exist on anything like the scale it does today before 1983, yet most of them vote for the Liberal Party, and he can't understand it. Neither can Bob Hawke. It's a good question. So those people in Hawke and Keating's view should be Labor voters, but Labor doesn't know how to talk to those people anymore or advocate the same kind of free market policies. But how did he do it? Well, I think there's a couple of things. One is necessity. The words of Lee Kuan Yew that Australia would be the poor white trash of Asia rang very loudly in Hawke and Keating's ears and a number of other ministers around the table. They knew they had to change. Australia couldn't keep going the way it was, and they felt that a number of significant reforms hadn't been achieved by the Fraser government. Interesting, when you go back in the record, when the Campbell Inquiry came out, which recommended deregulation of the economy, the two people in Bill Hayden's shadow cabinet who said, "We've got to back this," were Paul Keating and Bob Hawke. But the leader, Hayden, and the shadow treasurer, Ralph Willis, were against it. So they had the right instincts, and they had the instincts before they were in office. But economic necessity was a big motivator. The other thing was the failures of the Whitlam government. I mean, Hawke and Keating and Hayden, to his credit, understood those failures writ large about what had happened to Labor under Whitlam, and the Labor Party became much craftier, much smarter, much sophisticated, more intellectual in terms of understanding some of the problems. And one of the key things is being pragmatic. They were a very pragmatic government, whereas the Whitlam was anything but pragmatic.
So, who have I missed?
Yep.
Stuart. Stephen, what is Justice Murphy's reputation as a judge himself? How is his judgments and decisions, how do they hold up?
I think they hold up a lot better now than they did at the time he gave them. I think looking back 30 years, people on both sides of politics in the legal profession have high regard for many of his judgments. There has been at least one book come out of his the more significant judgments that he gave. I think he's probably one of the very few judges of the High Court to have had that happen to. His judgments were typically short, and he often took what other judges might have thought of as shortcuts. But if you, when he was on the court, if you went to look at a judgment, a case, and you wanted to find out a bit about it fairly quickly, you'd usually go to Murphy's judgment because it'd be the shortest. But it'd often be the most succinct and well argued.
What about his personality? The official history of ASIO covering the infamous Murphy-led raid on ASIO in Melbourne in 1973, indicates that what happened was he does a raid on ASIO, and effectively he takes all the staff and throws them into a theatrette and virtually imprisons them for 3 hours and they can't get out. I mean, you wouldn't do that these days. I mean, that would be an act of workplace bullying. So, well, it would be. I mean, you can't imprison staff for 3 hours in a theatrette and not allow them out. So, what do you see any other examples of that when he was on the court or in relation to the book you're writing about, or was that sort of one-off?
No, I think it was a one-off. He certainly... Certainly, there was nothing like that when he was a judge. But he was obviously very passionate about getting the files, particularly the file about himself, and that's what drove him, I suppose.
But the file about himself didn't exist, did it?
Well, I think that was one of the things that he was looking for.
But it wasn't there.
No, I know. But I think from what I've heard recently from another from a journalist who was around at the time. That was one of his objects in carrying out the raid.
Thank you. There's a question here. Yeah. Yes. You had your hand up? No. Okay. Yes, question there.
Question.
Let's speak up a bit.
Question for Troy. Some critics of Paul Keating say one of the things he did was to introduce mandatory detention of black people. Did you
So did you cover the introduction of mandatory detention in 1991, I think?
Yeah, 92, 93, I did. Yeah. It's an important issue, and I talked to Gerry Hand, who was the immigration minister up to 93, and then Nick Bolkus, I spoke to him, he was the immigration minister after. Look, there's no doubt that that was the beginning of the present system. But I think Keating can argue convincingly that it's not the current system. It was a different type of system and there were different motivations. It is true they did introduce that mandatory detention of refugees. It was mainly on the basis of trying to control refugees and monitor them and assess them properly. Gerry Hand told me he went to Port Hedland, for example, and stayed in the facility overnight, and refugee activist groups were given full access to it, so was the media. So, look, it's a different type of system, but it is the beginning of it. The Keating government can't deny that. But there are some other important issues about, particularly Nick Bolkus telling me that the cabinet had a very clear view about boat turnbacks, for example. Cabinet supported that as a strategy. They supported an orderly refugee program where people should come from refugee camps, not be able to just arrive in Australia, and that's why they introduced mandatory detention. So there are clearly a lot of links between the system today and the system then, although Keating doesn't want to be tagged with the Howard Pacific solution.
Question there?
Of Paul Keating and Laurie Brereton stealing ballot boxes and taking off with them on the back of motorbikes. They were media reports. Is there any truth in that, and have you investigated?
So there's a question about the famous pre-selection where Laurie Brereton and Paul Keating allegedly pinched ballot boxes and drove off on motorcycles.
This is one of the great stories in the book, and it's all told in the Labor Party's archives in the State Library. They didn't steal ballot boxes, but there were ballot boxes involved, and there was a motorbike involved. I'll give you a very quick summary. This is the 1968 pre-selection for Blaxland. Keating was 24 years old. The sitting member had been there for 20 years. There were five candidates. And Keating came through and defeated them all. Huge pitchforked battle between the left faction and the Labor right faction. I interviewed a couple of people that are still alive who are involved in that pre-selection, and Keating, he still gets very cranky about it. The party office, there was a number of disputes about who was eligible to vote and who wasn't eligible to vote. In the end, the party office's decisions effectively sided with Keating, and he won that ballot. It doesn't mean that the left were robbed, because as Keating once said to a Labor Party conference, I out-cheated the cheats. So they were both cheating, right? There's no doubt about that. But Keating was a better cheater. And he actually had more of a moral claim, because a lot of the people he did recruit into the Labor Party were genuine recruits, whereas a lot of the people in the left faction were people who were just names on books and didn't exist and the branches didn't meet and things like that. So look, there's a moral weighing up here, what is more legitimate or not. But quickly on the question about the motorbike, what they did was when they counted the ballot, it was at the Scout Hall in Bankstown. The local returning officer who conducted the ballot was in the left faction. He refused to count a number of the ballots that would have given Keating victory on the night. The Keating supporters, Laurie Brereton, Ron Dyer, his family were there. They weren't going to stand for this. They wanted those ballots counted on the night, and they wanted Keating to be declared the winner. There was a standoff. The police were called. The police arrived and thought, we're not going to do anything about this. It went on for hours and hours and hours. And a day before there were mobile phones, Laurie Brereton, who was scrutineering another ballot across town, he arrived late, realised what was happening. He got on his motorbike and sped off to the nearest phone box. And who did he ring to fix this problem? He rang Gough Whitlam, who had only been leader of the Labor Party at that stage for just over a year. He was in very shaky territory, but he knew that Paul Keating would be a vote for him in caucus. What did Laurie Brereton want Gough Whitlam to do? He wanted Gough Whitlam to ring the party's state returning officer, who was an MLC, who was living in the inner city, and get him out of bed, take him out, get him out to Bankstown to seize the ballot boxes so the left couldn't declare that Keating had lost the ballot. So Gough Whitlam did that. Some hours later, the state returning officer arrived. They could still see his pyjamas beneath his clothes. He was very angry and made everybody know that he was very angry. He seized the ballot boxes, put them in the back of his car, and he said, "I'm taking these to the party office and we'll sort them out on Monday." A number of other events happened, challenges, hearings, but in the end, Keating came out on top.
Finally, Richard. Yep.
Troy.
Yes.
During the Hawke-Keating period, Hawke, of course, had been the president of the ACTU, very, very influential. But I don't think you would have ever heard at that time that the Parliamentary Labour Party was a subsidiary of the trade union movement, whereas it's an often said thing today. How could you compare the two eras?
Well, you can't compare them. It's not just the Labor Party's relationship to the trade union movement, it's the trade union movement's relationship to the Labor Party. I interviewed a lot of ACTU people, Jenny George, Martin Ferguson, Simon Crean, Bill Kelty. They were partners in the reform project. They realised how significant the challenges were facing the economy. The key thing was the social wage. We'll accept wage moderation in return for the social wage benefits like Medicare, education and so on. That was the key thing, and there were trade-offs involved. You wouldn't just get an NDIS, for example, or Gonski funding without an industrial trade-off. So everything was done on trade-offs, huge negotiations, bargains. The Accord was the framework to do that. Keating was an Accord sceptic. He thought it was a policy to get Labor through an election campaign in 1983, not a policy for government, but he became an Accord warrior in Bill Kelty's terms. And Hawke, as a former ACTU president, was often a part of those things as well. But it was a partnership. I mean, it was a recognition that we've got to do things together and avoid the problems of the Whitlam years, ironically, when Bob Hawke was often arguing against Whitlam government policies. But that was the difference. And I don't think today we have a Labor Party that is able to take on the unions and ask for things in return, or a union movement willing to give them up, looking at the bigger picture. And when you talk to all of those former trade union leaders I mentioned, they feel the same way. They lament what has happened. That great partnership is no longer there, and the union movement now is far more powerful in terms of its influence inside the Labor Party than it ever would have. And Bob Hawke told me, for example, a couple of years ago that he would have expelled the CFMEU long ago. But there's Bill Shorten still happy to accept the CFMEU influence, CFMEU money, when it is a rogue militant union. That would never have happened in the Hawke-Keating government.
Just a final question to Stephen. Your book sold very well. Has there been any sort of pushback by the surviving members of the Lionel Murphy fan club, which was once very substantial?
Not to me. I guess I'll hear about it eventually. The only response I've had is from close friends, or former close friends, who found the odd error.
How remarkably honest.
Oh, hang on. God, we were finishing now.
I'm with the National Archives Advisory Board, and this applies to the documents, just how much is going to come out and how quickly, because it's still very complicated. I mean, the clerks can still wade through it and determine how much has come out. I mean, it's been an annoying thing for the archives for years now that no one can get access. But just how much will get out and how
Well, I mean, you can offer an opinion about that.
Your second edition.
Well, will there be a second edition? with the facts corrected, yeah.
Could be waiting a decade or something. I mean, is it really going to happen quickly?
I don't know. I don't know what the vested interests are.
That's right, exactly.
If I knew that, I'd have a much better idea. But I rather naively expected that on the 24th of September last year we'd all get them. But how wrong was that?
It's very vague.
Hmm. It'll take a while.
You might have come across some of that.
No, I haven't.
Skeletons.
I'm sorry.
So, look, if the documents are released and we go for a second edition, we'll have... and your next book, which will probably be out next week, we'll have you back too. So, look, thanks to both Troy Bramson, who, made a welcome return, and to Stephen Walmsley, who's a first-up appearance here, and thanks to Cause Chambers Westgarth for the use of this facility. Without question, Lionel Murphy and... Paul Keating were two of the most significant figures in Australian history. Keating essentially in politics, Lionel Murphy in law and politics. So it's been
important for us tonight at the Sydney Institute to hear an account of a controversy involving the late Lionel Murphy and accounts of the ongoing controversies of various kinds involving the very alive Paul Keating, so who's been a speaker here at the Sydney Institute in the past. So thanks to both our authors and speakers tonight. Books are available there if you haven't got them. But for tonight, to both of you, thank you and well done.
You have been listening to the Sydney Institute podcast. This podcast is proudly brought to you through the support of Microsoft Australia. We hope you enjoyed listening and can join us again soon.